It's not often you get to take a pulpit and have the pastor present with you. And so it's nice to see everybody here today. Usually when there's a guest, everybody kind of disappears for the Sunday. So this is a privilege to be with you this morning. It's always good to be back here. This is our home. It was our home church from 1996, when I was just a new believer at Ohio State, until we moved to lead the ministry in Cleveland in 2011. So it's always a privilege to come back here and serve the people who nurtured us, continue to do so, care for us. Many, many mission dollars have flowed through this congregation, both corporately and individually, to keep us on the mission field with Crew. And so winning, building, and sending college students. It's been the great joy of my life to send young men and Jenny, young women, into the harvest field as leaders and laborers for the kingdom. And now, after being in Cleveland for 7 years, we're seeing some of that same fruit developing. And God's been extremely faithful in that. I want to put a picture up. This is a picture of our staff team. The owners of the Browns have become involved with our ministry, and they have been extravagant in their generosity to to the ministry. We hosted our first annual fundraising dinner at the stadium. We had an event room. This is right in the dog pound, and our event room was right behind it. So that picture is just evidence of God's faithfulness. When Jenny and I moved to Cleveland, it was just the two of us. We didn't know if anybody was going to follow us. And sure enough, some of the men and women that we discipled at Ohio State did come and join us. And we had others join, so this is our team. But that picture also has some bitterness with it. Two of the team members we had to dismiss after a really long, patient process for not living in accord with their missionary vows. And one is now in inpatient rehab, and we remain in touch and good friends and prayerful. And the other is sadly unrepentant. We've had trying years, but this has been the worst for us. It was brutal. I mean, it sent shockwaves through our team and directly touched half of the campuses that we were on in Northeast Ohio. So we're coming through a very tough season. In March, we had our second child, John, who's in the front row here with Jenny. And then 2 weeks after that, I tore my bicep. So it literally snapped right off the bone. And so I just regained use of my arm. I had surgery immediately after that, and now I can play with my boys again. But 2 weeks after, so Jenny had three kids at that point. And because of some struggles our oldest son is having emotionally, we just started family therapy. We've been at wit's end as we've been dealing with this. Now, I say all this not as a sort of woe is me, but by way of introduction to our psalm this morning, our experience is just like your experience. We live between two worlds, between this already and not yet of Jesus' reign as king. We experience the blessings and the residual mess of the fall, side by side, and sometimes even minute by minute. This past weekend, I got to officiate the wedding of two former Crew students. Well, she came to know the Lord through our ministry. They both were developed in leadership and mission skills. He's in medical school now to be a missionary doctor. What a privilege. On Monday, we got to spend time with a young dating couple from Baldwin Wallace, and they had asked us if they could come to our home and meet with us for just wisdom as they're dating and as they're thinking about engagement. But then to Tuesday after, we were worried that our son was going to get kicked out of camp. And so, you know, just the, you know, we live constantly between these two things. And then that same day, I was looking at our bank statements. I'm like, I think we're going to get a short paycheck. And that same day, a former student made a deposit into our staff account. He just had a sense. And so you have these sense of blessing and curse side by side as we live it. And this is our experience. I know it to be your experience. And the Psalms have a way of forming us and shaping us for faith if we'll find ourselves inside that ancient narrative. The book of Psalms brings us into Old Testament Israel's history, into the relational, emotional life of Israel with their God, and there's a parallel of their journey with God and our journey. So today we're going to look at Psalm 131 in the midst of your Psalm series. But before we go any further, I want to give you just a brief classification for the Psalms, which I found so helpful. It came from Walter Brueggemann, and I think you'll find it really intuitive. So the simple classification for the Psalms is this. It's orientation, disorientation, and reorientation. What I mean by that is that orientation, these are periods in your life when things are going well. And the Psalms, there are periods where you read the Psalms and you go, yes, things are going well. You have declarations of who God is, and they're strong and they're dogmatic and they're worshipful. You know that the world is fair and right. It's just. It's as it should be. And frankly, in these Psalms, things seem very black and white. And then in the disorientation, life happens. And we come smack up against the fallen world that we live in. And the old declarations don't seem so much to cut it as they used to. Questions begin to arise. We begin to ask, is it really that way? God, are you really as you say you are? Are you good? Are you there? The world seems much less black and white in this period. And we begin to take our questions to God because the answers we've had in the past have seemed insufficient. And then reorientation. Reorientation are times that we've come through. God shows up. He delivers. He does something. We make it. And we pass through the darkness. And then we know, in the same way we knew in orientation, but now we know in a deeper way, in a more trusting way. And most of the songs we sang this morning were actually reorientation songs. They were songs that declare some history with God and that he's true and he's faithful. So let's read our Psalm 131. Let's put it up there. And I'll read it from the NIV right now. So Psalm 131, a song of ascents of David. My heart is not proud, Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me, but I have calmed and quieted myself. I am like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child, I am content. Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. Okay, if I ask a question, which of those do you think it is? Orientation, orientation, disorientation, or reorientation? Reorientation. Yeah, you can tell there's a sense of a history. There's a sense of we've come through something and now I've calmed myself. So yeah, it's very intuitive. Now, why is this important? Because on the other side of disorientation is reorientation, if we can make it. If we make it through, there's a reorientation that will happen. And the Psalms give us permission to be in the midst of disorientation. They give us permission to live with the emotion, to be in the midst of the struggle, and to ask God questions. That's not heresy, to go to God with your question, to doubt, to ask. And we make it through if it doesn't crush us. But we have these disorienting events all the time. And as just an aside, college students are not making it through this disorientation period left and right. I mean, this is what we're experiencing over and over. They don't get through these seasons of disorientation, and much of that is, and the rejection of church is because they haven't experienced the safety to actually be there, to ask tough questions and to get answers, to make it through their doubt. But when we make it through, our faith deepens, it's grounded, and our confidence in God grows because now it's based on the evidence of experience of his faithfulness. So let me give you our context. It says, we read a song of ascents. Well, what does that mean? Well, three times a year, Israel would travel to Jerusalem for holy feast days. And so they would pick up their whole family, and in caravans, they would travel from their cities to make it to Jerusalem. No matter where you are in Jerusalem, you could be south, east, north, or west, or in Israel, wherever you are, you're said to go up to Jerusalem. There was great emotion and anticipation to go to the holy city, the city of God, Mount Zion, to worship. This is the place they believed God to dwell. The idea here is ascending journey to worship. And so most believe that these were designated travel songs on the pilgrimage as you were going to Jerusalem and possibly sung by worshipers as they ascended the 15 steps to the temple. So it was 15, 120 to 134. And they would sing them on each step of the temple as they went up into the court. Now, they've taken time out of their day-to-day lives. They've set themselves apart to travel to Jerusalem, and they're going to the place where God's chosen to dwell. And it only happened periodically throughout the year. And so as they set out in caravans on foot, and much different than our travel today, Israel would naturally reflect on, they would take time, and they would reflect on their relationship with God in preparation, their place with Him, the blessings they experience with Him that He's afforded, the aspects of life as an Israelite under God's rule, anticipating their arrival in the holy city. Now, interestingly, these psalms have actually been arranged in such a way that bear the marks of this journey. So I just want to briefly survey some of these with you. The headings alone will be sufficient, or the first line or so, to verify this. But if you open up in your Bibles to Psalm 120, and we'll start there. And this is just so fascinating. But Psalm 120, so this is the start. And you know how Psalm 120 starts? It starts with distress and fatigue from dwelling among those who just don't get it, who are outside of God's family. And so this is the impulse. Let's get up out of here and let's go to Jerusalem. 121, they start to survey the journey. Look at the hills. So they're on the road, look out at the hills, take note of the sun and the shade by day and the moon by night. 122, reminder of the call to go to Jerusalem and the happiness that's provoked in his heart. 125, safety on the journey. 127, there's a reminder of bread and sleep and that God's the provider. And you could imagine him looking to his children as he pulls out the food that he's packed for the journey and being reminded that, reminding himself that mouths to feed are blessings from the Lord. 128, the blessings of husband and wife and the works of their hands as they're on the way. 129, anger at those who've made life miserable in the past. And so there's kind of this recounting. 130, acknowledgement of one's own sin, as he's been thinking about the sins of others and begins to reflect on his own. And then Psalm 131, which we'll look at this morning. And then it seems this is the point of arrival, when they actually get to the city. And then we have 132, the promise of David, that his throne's going to last forever. And 133, the blessing of unity among the people. And 134, arrival at the temple. And you can just imagine high fives to the priests as they go in to worship God, that they're doing the exact thing that they've come to do, and they've prepared the way for them. So journey is this incredibly powerful metaphor in the Christian life. Ancient Israel's story sometimes feels really distant or unfamiliar to us, but you can totally imagine the complexity of emotion that might fill a heart on such a journey, and even just in the course of a couple hours as they reflect on their God. In your reflection before the Lord, you could pass through all of these emotions, even the matter of a few hours just sitting around a campfire, thinking about where you've been and where you're going as you rest your feet and your body on the journey. Well, because of this, the Psalms of Ascent are almost like a mini book in the Psalms. All the types, orientation, disorientation, reorientation appear here. And these Psalms follow this grand journey to worship. But it does in micro, in these 15 chapters, it does what the whole book of Psalms does from beginning to end in a macro way, until we finally arrive at the hallelujahs in the end of the book, which are this proclamation before the Lord, anticipating heaven. So let's look again at Psalm 131. This time I'll read it in the ESV. A Song of Ascents of David. O Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. But I have calmed and quieted my soul. Like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. This particular psalm is ascribed to David. Not all of these psalms are, and some suggest that this might be a reflection of peace that David felt at the time when God delivered him from the hand of Saul in 2 Samuel 22. And it might very aptly describe David's heart during that circumstance. David has waited, he's endured, and now it's done. God did it. He's at rest. David says his heart is not proud. The ESV says it's not lifted up. The same words used in Isaiah 57 when we read that the Lord is high and lifted up. And we put these things two side by side, and it's easy to see. David is saying, I have not sought to exalt my name or ascribe to myself what only belongs to God. I have not positioned my eyes above the Lord, but beneath him. God's the one who sees. God's the one who knows. He has the big picture. There's a humble quietude that's come over David. My mind is not absorbed in things that rightfully belong in God's purview. David can't wrap his mind around the ideas of God's infinite and detailed knowledge. In Psalm 139, it causes him to use the words, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high. I cannot attain it. In other words, your thoughts are not my thoughts. It's not that David doesn't think on big things. This is not an intellectual cop-out. He meditates on them. But it's about posture. He knows, at least for this moment, not only his place, but his relationship with God. This calmness comes from seeing and knowing, you are God and I am not. That releases me from being God in my own life. When I recognize him, I don't have the burden of being God. He carries it perfectly well, and I'm ill-equipped to carry it. And all the things I would look to can't bear the weight the way he can carry it. Now, go back to our context. You can see how this ancient scribes and arrangers of the book of Psalms would place this Psalm of David here amidst the ascents. What a posture to cultivate as you near the holy city to worship. You can also see how the metaphor and theme of a weaned child, the psalm, fits beautifully in this context on the journey. Surrounded by family, maybe around a campfire, husband and wife, children, others from the nation of Israel, you could imagine an Israelite sitting by the firelight under the starry night, looking over his brood, glancing at one of his children with their head resting on his wife's neck. And that becoming the picture of the posture that he has before God. And whatever had been going on in this man's head previously, whether it was fear or unrest of some kind, thoughts about his past, others' evil, his own sin, something has transpired to put those thoughts at ease. His mind was blurry or cloudy or chaotic, disoriented, but now it's not. And the comfort and peace that he knows that child experiences in their innocence and their protection of his mom, he says, that's how I now feel. Like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child, I am content. So this is really powerful imagery. A weaned child is a child which no longer takes food from the breast. In Hebrew culture, that might have happened as late as 3 years old. And so now think about the difference between a baby and a weaned child. As a baby, the only means of communication is crying. And so if they need anything at all, they're having their needs met quickly. I mean, we jump to respond from the earliest of days. This is how the baby learns how the world is, and the parents can be trusted for their care, that they will be taken care of. So as babies, they always have their needs and desires met very, very quickly. They're nearly on demand, whether it's their cold, or their hungry, or their sickness, or diapers, or fear. As a child grows and develops, he begins taking solid food. He still takes milk at the breast, but much less frequently. Now he no longer needs it for sustenance. But both mom and baby actually do this for their nurture, in the sense of security and nearness to mom, the warmth of her skin, her smell, the physical bonding. And then the nursing ends. I mean, of course it has to. It's a good thing. But it's a difficult thing, especially if it's been delayed for as a child gets older. Tantrums may even result, because this comfort, this nearness is being pulled away a little bit. The same kind of crying as when he was just a little baby. But if he grows through it, and he does, it ends. This doesn't mean mom has abandoned him. It doesn't mean that his needs will no longer be met. It doesn't mean she doesn't care or love him. All these things are still true. And no more deeply. Trust has developed in a very intimate way. And there's a peacefulness and repose in being and even in waiting. We transitioned our oldest son, Joe, to his big boy bed at about 2.5 years old. And our routine had been we'd bounce on the bed at night, and then we'd put his PJs on, throw his dirty clothes in the laundry chute, brush our teeth, and then we'd head to bed. And we'd say, calm, flat legs. And Mama would lay next to him, and we'd hold hands and pray together, and she would read her bedtime stories, and he'd eat some animal crackers until he'd fall asleep. When it started, it was a struggle to keep him in bed, in his big boy bed. We didn't have the rails of the crib anymore. First, since he knew he could get up, I mean, he would just get up. Then, as we began to teach him to fall asleep, he'd wake up, and then he'd realize, I can get out of here. And so he would, you know, we'd hear the pitter-patter, he'd come downstairs, so we'd put a cover on the doorknob. And he would cry out, sobbing, Mama, door! And we'd go back, and we'd put him to sleep. But the process grew easier and quicker. He cuddled with Mom, they'd read, he'd roll over and go to sleep. And sometimes if she tried to leave too early, he'd say, "Mama, here." Sometimes he'd even start to realize that he might fall asleep faster if she wasn't in the room. And so she'd say, so there were a few nights, say, "Mama, leave." And that was kind of tough on Mom. But he was just showing us that he was growing. Now, every now and then, he'd still wake up and have a moment of fear. And we'd hear the patter of feet on the floor, sobbing, and Joey crying at the door, "Mama, door!" And there's no shame in that for Joey. He was just a toddler, and he was growing up. We never outgrow our need for God. In that sense, we're always children. But now, we know him and we relate to him differently as we mature. How we trust him grows. We have histories of faithfulness to draw on, greater intimacy in how we know him, ways we've seen him prove it. We learn trust that produces peace. We make fewer demands of infancy. We're less neurotic in our fear. There's a knowledge that he comes through. We grow in our capacity to handle life like Jesus because we trust God more. You know, in Jesus, we have his abiding presence through his Spirit always with us, issued from the throne of risen Jesus to come and dwell our hearts and provide abiding comfort. Paul talks about the peace beyond understanding that can guard our hearts and minds. This is what he's talking about. Jesus, having covered our sin entirely, wiped it clean. Jesus, having dealt a death blow to the curse, so it has no power over us any longer, and the promise of having every evil wiped away and restored. But even in our journey post-resurrection, knowing what we know, these periods of quietude and peace and comfort, they're moments, and they're only moments. And you abide. We're reminded of our comfort, and the curse shows its face again. But I want to leave you with this thought. There's none who had this weaned child disposition like Jesus. He trusted the Father completely. And it wasn't stoic disregard where he didn't experience any emotion. It wasn't comfortable protection from the stain of the world, which I think that can lead us to avoid emotion. But it was trust. And at the cross, Jesus cried, "Papa, door!" And behind the door of death, a desperate son seemingly received no relief. There was no running to his side to comfort him, no angels, no immediate deliverance. There seemed to be silence. And then the father opened the door and embraced the son. If you want to know how Jesus endured, the Spirit was bringing the son's heart into conversation with the father. In fact, we don't have time to look at it, but if you have time today, go to Psalm 102. And there, this is written by a psalmist, but Hebrews 1 picks it up as a quotation that Jesus refers to. And somehow in that psalm, you have the psalmist actually, I think, giving us a picture into the conversation that's going on in the Godhead. And paragraph to paragraph, you have the Son talking to the Father and being reminded of who he is and what's going on. Fascinating if you try to follow it. Now listen, in Jesus, the one who sits confidently at the Father's right hand, as his brothers and sisters, the peace that he knew and then willingly sacrificed and now knows again, that peace is our birthright. That peace that he knew belongs to us. These longtime Carl Road members, you might be following Brian and Amy Shaw and Brian's battle with cancer. And what you're witnessing in them is an example of this kind of weaned faith and trust. They know their God. So let me know, if there's some area of your life that seems like the door is closed, it's a period of disorientation, Jesus is proof that God comes through even if that door is death. God comes through. So we can be at rest without panic, without demands, without power struggles to forge the future that we believe ought to be, but waiting on God. So as I bring Rick up to close, let me just leave you with a couple of questions for reflection. In what ways have you grown in resting in the Lord? Surely you've grown as you've known God and walked with him. What burden could you release into his arms this morning that's been weighing heavy and it's not been peace? Can you recognize any demands of infancy, neurotic in fear, trying to manipulate God? In what ways are you yelling, Papa, door? And the waiting is hard. How might God help you to know his peacefulness this morning? Lastly, I want to just ask you, in what ways has he proved himself to you?